Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hello, I'm Danny Pellegrino, host of the Everything Iconic podcast. And this holiday season, I'm once again joined by my buddy, writer and comedian Jenna Brister.
Hey, Danny, happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Is it too early?
No, never.
Never, never. Yeah. That's right. And season 5 of our holiday movie recap podcast, A Very Merry Iconic Podcast, we'll be covering all of your Christmas favorites. This year, we're covering A Christmas Story, mm-hmm. The Grinch.
The Grinch, again.
Again.
Because we have more thoughts.
We always have more thoughts on that Grinch. Monster. Love him. That's right. We're breaking down the seasonal films while taking plenty of detours along the way. So grab your cocoa.
Grab your peppermint schnapps.
Meet us by the fire. For our exact schedule, you can follow us on Instagram at A Very Merry Iconic Podcast.
It's finally that time.
So get in the holiday spirit with A Very Merry Iconic Podcast, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
The 80s Rewind Show Podcast.
It's time to bring you yet another amazing episode. And now. Welcome your host,
Rob, the face for Radio Burgess.
Enjoy the show.
Hello, hello, it's the 80s Rewind Show podcast with me, Rob, the face for Radio Burgess. And welcome along to today's show, or podcast, depending on what you call it. How you doing? I hope you're doing all right. Hope you're diddling well and keeping yourself safe and happy and all the good stuff in the world. So I went over to the website, the 80s Rewind Show podcast website, which is
www.the80spod.com.
And what I've did, if you go on there and go down to the bottom, there's a little playlist. And every artist we've had on the show so far, I've put their songs on there. So you've got a bit of a playlist. So if you go over to
www.the80spod.com
and pop on there, you can hear all the tracks of all the artists that we've had on the show. And as we go on, I'll build them more and more. So the library will get massive, hopefully, by the end of next year. It'll be like 2 million tracks or something. Anyway, I'm overreaching, but that's the kind of guy I am. You've got to aim big, haven't you? And if you go on there, there's all sorts of stuff you can look at, including tracks which haven't been released yet. The artists have specially sent them to me, and I've put them on the website. So if you go on there, top banner, scroll along, exclusive to site. There's a couple of tracks on there that you can't get anywhere else. I'm absolutely chuffed. They're wonderful people. That's my friend Jane going, here you go, lovely man again, calling everybody wonderful, because apparently I do that every episode. But what can I say? They're nice people. On there, you can contact me for email if you've got any questions or if you just want to talk about some of the guests. If not, you can email me direct at
the80srewindshow@gmail.com.
Right, I'll do it again because I like pressing buttons.
the80srewindshow@gmail.com.
Yeah, so when you get a chance, check out the website. Also, if you're on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you get a chance to listen to your podcasts, if you could pop on and write me a little review, that'd be absolutely amazing so that more people can find the show. And spread the love and tell everybody about it if you can. Tell the postman, tell the butcher, tell the baker and the candlestick maker. Can you still get candlestick makers? That'd be an ironmonger, wouldn't it? Anyway, today's guest, who have I got for you today? I've got the one and only Kevin Patterson from Fiction Factory. We had a lovely chat about writing the song Feels Like Heaven, where the band got the name from and what he's doing nowadays, and the next step for Fiction Factory. We had a lovely chat. Lovely guy. Jane, I can hear you saying it to me again. Stop saying it. Anyway, but it's true. He was. We had a great time. So anyway, let's crack on, shall we? Let's do it. What sort of music was playing in the house when you were growing up? What sort of music was around?
I kind of became aware of music in the 60s, I suppose. And my mum and dad, mostly my mum, I think, was, you know, quite into stuff that was happening. And she would pretty regularly come home with a single or something. And it would be paraded into the house, a bit like a gold bar. And, you know, oh, I've got this new single. And we'd all sit down by the portable record player that we had, and we would sit down and be really kind of reverential listening to this thing. So I think my mum was quite, she had quite varied tastes in music. Country and Western was a thing. My dad was a bit more kind of immovable in his tastes. Country and Western was probably the thing that unified them.
Yeah,
but my mum had slightly more kind of exotic tastes. But I do remember the radio always seemed to be on. Radio 1 always seemed to be on. And, you know, it may be a false memory, but I remember you know, the Walker Brothers and, you know, the Righteous Brothers, you know, all of those things. The Walker Brothers particularly seemed to, I don't know if it was the sort of the low register or of the vocals, but it just seemed to be something that stuck with me for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, Bacharach and David, all of those things, I didn't know at the time who had written them, but it was all of that kind of sound, that big sort of Phil Spector kind of sound. And that is what seems to have stuck, you know, as I was growing up. But it was pretty varied. You know, I remember my dad wasn't overly keen on it, but I remember hearing Ska and Desmond Dekker and going, what the hell is that?
Fantastic.
What language is that he's singing? So just really, really pretty varied pop, really. And it's interesting to look back on it because obviously the Fiction Factory, we did do quite a varied, there wasn't really a style, I suppose. And so I think the varied aspect of the pop music, it wasn't particularly deep, it was Radio 1, singles, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And with hindsight, I think probably my mum was the big driver in sort of opening my eyes to different kinds of music, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's just amazing it does sound very varied as well. I mean, especially country and western.
Yeah,
it's interesting. A lot of people I've been talking to say country was a large part. It's just crazy that, you know, this music from miles away would be influencing people in Scotland and London. And
yeah, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think certainly Scotland has a bit of a tradition with country and western, and it seemed to have permeated up here. We had... who did we have? We had Sidney Devine, I suppose, was the big guy. Not sure about the quality in his own particular style, but he, you know, certainly the West Coast, he seemed to be quite a big thing there. But yeah, I remember Blanket on the Ground and, you know, Tammy Wynette and all of those things. Even my grandparents were into, you know, Jim Reeves and all of those things. And so they've all kind of stuck somewhere in my head and I guess come out in a few different ways with the stuff that I've done, you know, going on from there.
Yeah.
But yeah, country western. I mean, I didn't really quite understand or appreciate country music when I was growing up. Certainly when I was into punk and new wave, you definitely didn't own up to having anything to do with that. But you know, as I've kind of grown a bit older, perhaps a bit wiser, then it has kind of become something a bit like a nice single malt. It's matured over time, and now I appreciate it in small doses.
That's regular listen to the podcast when my dad played in a country band all his life.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Right. Oh.
And like yourself, I absorbed all of those songs. Every weekend he would play, so we'd go in a van somewhere, you know. So my childhood was really interesting. It was school Monday to Friday, Friday night in a van, going up to, you know, Cornwall and sometimes Scotland and all these places to hear him play the country music. And like yourself, at the time, I thought, oh, this is just naff. And then, you know, now I listen to it, like, oh God, that guitar player is amazing. You know, like you definitely, you're right. You definitely grow into that music, I think. And then our country is like amazingly cool. You're like, you've got the C2C festival and, you know, it's bigger than it's ever been. I mean, I suppose for like my dad's and your parents, it was like the rebel music of the time. It was, you know, it was, everyone was listening to Jim Reeves and all this sort of stuff. And then you've got something completely different, you know, like Blanket on the Ground and all that West Coast sound from country. It's absolutely amazing. So when you first got into singing and like sort of songwriting, was country an influence on you in that sense, or was it just a mix of everything that did it?
When I got into singing, that was a total accident. But, you know, I'd been doing music for quite a while, really starting at school, and started off on the bass guitar eventually. Because music was a complete accident for me. I dropped music as soon as I could at school. It was very kind of dull, the way it was taught. You know, it's a very sort of Billy Connolly kind of thing. Okay, your heart would sink when the teacher came in with an LP under his arm going, right, class, we're going to appreciate this. You're going to listen to it and you're going to appreciate this for the entire class. And there seemed to be no point to it. It was just, you would listen to it and it wasn't even, you know, we would write about it. It was just, you know, obviously the teacher was hungover or something, I don't know. But I dropped music as soon as I could because I found it really boring. I didn't really get anything from it. And as I was at school and kind of getting towards the end of leaving, I still didn't really know what I wanted to do. I was quite bright, and I was quite good at languages, but I didn't really know what I wanted to do. And just one day I walked into the common room where a bunch of my friends were all kind of huddled together, and they were quite agitated, and they said they were going to form a band.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, right, okay, that's brilliant. Not anything serious, just let's get together and do stuff. And I thought, oh, that's brilliant. Can I join? And I said, yeah, that's you. What do you play? And I said, nothing, but I can learn. So I thought, right, okay, I'm in a band. What am I going to do? So I started to try the guitar, and I just had sausage fingers. If you've ever seen Everything Everywhere All at Once, it was a bit like the people with the hot dog fingers. I couldn't get my fingers around the chords. So I thought, shit, what am I going to do? There's this other thing. There's this other kind of guitar called a bass. I'll try that because that's less strings. Surely that's going to be easier. And it was amazing. It was a real kind of very kind of filmic thing for me, where it was suddenly this whole room had been unlocked that I didn't quite know was there. When I picked up the bass and I started playing it, and I thought, I wasn't very good, but I thought, no, this is, I want to do this.
Yeah.
This is the thing that I want to do. And it's a very, very sort of rare thing. I was a bass player. I started as a bass player.
Wow.
I've been in a few bands as a bass player, and doing some backing vocals, because singing and playing is actually quite difficult. And the bass, particularly in the drums as well, it's a different kind of thing, because you're playing one thing, but you're singing, you know, sometimes in a different timing. So it's quite a skill, and I couldn't do it now, but I was doing it then. So singing was a bit of an accident, because with Fiction Factory, having done quite a few bands, and I can fully get going in a van up to whatever after your job or whatever, because we did that as well. But when we started Fiction Factory, the first song that we wrote, we thought, well, it's got to have a singer on it. So do we know any singers? And we all kind of looked around and went, no, don't really. Well why don't I do it? I'll do it for this song. We'll get somebody, but, you know, we'll do it for this song. Of course, we didn't. possibly just laziness, I don't know. And sort of went from there. So singing was a bit of an accident, I think. So I've forgotten your original question, but singing was a bit of an accident, I'm afraid.
That's all right. So you were singing, you were playing bass in bands for a little while before you formed Fiction Factory. Is that right?
Yeah.
And with your friends that were in Fiction in these bands, was it you just kept changing the name, or was it you were you know what I mean? Every other week, a new name.
To avoid detection, yes. Yeah. We changed our names before the stands. Well, Eddie and I, the keyboard player, and he co-wrote Feels Like Heaven, we met early on in my musical journey. And we seemed to get on quite well, and we quite had the same sort of humour, and we both quite kind of liked experimenting with music and just different techniques and trying stuff, you know, as we were kind of progressing. And Perth at the time had quite a music scene. Really not so much now, unfortunately, but in those days it was quite a scene. And as you do, you kind of notice bands who are playing, and you sort of go to their gigs, and you look at them grudgingly, and you go, yeah, I suppose they're okay. They're quite good. Oh, that guy's quite good, I suppose. And there was this one band where Chick, who was the third member of Fiction Factory, who for whatever reason we just sort of thought, oh, that's that guy, he's quite good, there's something about him, and we just kind of gravitated together. Tried some things out ourselves, and we then heard that a ska sort of reggae band was looking to form, and so we kind of went to that, and then after we'd finished that, Fiction Factory was the next thing. So it was a gradual process, really.
Wow, so you could have been a ska band almost.
Well, yeah. We played lots and lots of gigs. I mean, we didn't last very long, probably less than 2 years, but we packed so much into that time playing. You know, I think in the last year we played over 300 gigs in a year.
Wow.
And that was with jobs and all of the stuff. One of us was running a business, and so we did a lot. We released a couple of singles. We had an album that was released in Europe, in the Benelux countries. So we did an awful lot, but it was a big band. And it could never hold together for very long. There were very strong characters, and there were almost two camps in the band. And one camp was probably a bit over-influenced by trends.
Right.
And they wanted to move on to the next thing. And we didn't. We kind of wanted to develop. And really, the band was going to go in a different way that I didn't want to go. So those famous musical differences, I'm afraid, they come along.
And what was the music scene like? Was it a tough scene to play back then, or was it quite open to new acts and stuff?
Yeah, I think we found it really not too bad. I mean, we seemed to, I don't know what it was, but we seemed to be quite well accepted by the biking community.
Wow.
It's weird because, you know, bikers and mods and rockers kind of thing. And we were playing ska and not just kind of not the right sort of music. But
yeah,
we would go down to Fife, which is a big sort of stronghold of rock music and, you know, heavy stuff.
Yeah.
And we would turn up at this place, and there would be a bunch of bikers there, you know, dancing away to ska, and you'd go, holy shit, this is weird. I think it was a really kind of exciting almost time in Scotland. There were so many kind of different bands with different ideas coming along. And it wasn't all just the one thing where, you know, you'd have punk and everybody thrashing away. We'd kind of gotten over that because this was in the 80s, the very early 80s. And so we'd kind of gotten over that kind of primal scream of punk and new wave. And then it was new romantic. And then, you know, it was kind of getting into that sort of really interesting period where it was okay to for example, as we did with Fiction Factory, we would have a band on the same night as a student theatre troupe who were going to do some sketches. You know, you just wouldn't do that now, but it just seemed to be quite open to doing that kind of thing. It was an interesting period, I think.
I mean, it sort of mirrors London. At the same time, they were doing sort of spoken word poetry with bands in the middle, like with, is it Robert Elms and Spandau Ballet? The same sort of thing where he came out and he read a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
And
they, yes,
it's very art, isn't it? Like, it's very in-house art. I like
that. Yeah, I still quite like the idea. I've always toyed with the idea of if ever Fiction Factory was going to do anything more seriously, to do something like that, not, you know, almost like a biography of the band, where it's not just playing, but it's maybe a bit of chat and a sort of playing influences.
Yeah,
it probably would attract an audience, a very small audience. But
I mean, it sounds awesome. I'd be there. It's great. My mates would be there. So I think you should look into that. I think that's a great idea. I mean, it's I mean, it's better than sort of just an audiobook. Like, if people can experience it as a, you know, and you're playing the songs as you go along, that'd be fantastic. That'd be really good.
I think the problem with Fiction Factory is because, you know, it's great to be a one-hit wonder, especially with Feels Like Heaven being that one hit. But it always feels and has felt, whenever we've done stuff in the past, you know, 10 years, 20 years, everybody's just waiting for us to do, feels like heaven. Nobody's really bothered about the other stuff. You know, there's maybe a couple of people in the crowd who are going, oh, I want to hear X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I'm willing to be persuaded. Or, oh, wow, I didn't realise that quite a broad breadth of styles. But everybody's just waiting for that one hit.
Right.
So in a way, I think that's a bit unfair in the audience because obviously as a band, you're going to kind of try and keep it right towards the end. And it just seems like that would be a more interesting thing to do rather than just do, okay, guys, you're going to have to sit here or stand here for 50 minutes. We'll do Feels Like Heaven, honestly, but just stand here and appreciate what we do, okay?
Or do it first and go, right, that's out of the way.
Yeah.
Or do like a half interlude. So you do half of the song at the start and then half at the end to finish it. Yeah.
Well, I seriously have a thought in the past of doing an album of different versions of Feels Like Heaven. You know, just different styles, a reggae style, a ska style, a rock style. Because people do it. You know, if you go to YouTube,
you'll see this whole
bunch of weird and wonderful versions of it. And I just kind of thought, well, that would be really good. And another thing I thought recently was, well, why don't we do some of the songs that we did in the set, but just do dance versions of them? So everybody's kind of really up and buzzing by the end, you know?
So it's
difficult. You know, people don't understand it's so difficult being a one-hit wonder.
You say that, but I mean, Heart of Minds is fantastic. You know, I mean, All or Nothing's a fantastic track. So, you know, you're going to get the people that love the album that come along. Yeah. So, yeah, you say one-hit wonder, but the album's fantastic. Anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. But so how did Fiction Factory form?
Fiction Factory really started with the three of us, Chick and Eddie and myself. And we had, as I said, we'd been kind of, you know, doing a musical journey together. But by the end of the ska band, who were called the RBs, we were really, really tired of playing live. We'd played so hundreds of gigs live, going all over the country, sometimes down to London, supporting bands and supporting Bad Manners and the Body Snatchers and, you know, lots of different bands. And, you know, it was just, we were just tired. We were just fed up.
Yeah.
We knew we had stuff to say. We didn't quite know what it was. But we just wanted to stop. The live stuff was just really far too much. And so the initial thinking with Fiction Factory was that we would write songs ideally for other people you know, just really go down that route and see if that brought any benefits or anything came of it. And of course, we probably weren't thinking about it awfully well, but we sort of started off and the first song that Eddie and I wrote together for Fiction Factory was Feels Like Heaven. So, you know, if you're going to start, you might as well start at the top. So that was the first one. And by that time, Chick was down in London. And we really probably hadn't thought about it because if we're going to write songs, you're going to have to demo them. And if you're going to demo them and they're going to have words, somebody has to sing it. So it was probably in hindsight a bit of an open goal that we didn't realize we were walking into, because in those days you send your demos off to record companies and say, that's great, we really want to see you live. So it's like, oh no, we've got to play live again. And so really that's where it came from. You know, we had a bit of toing and froing and we realized, well, God, we're going to have to play live. So we had to look around, because I'd been playing the bass on anything that required bass for Fiction Factory. We were sort of a synthy band, so a lot of it was done with synths.
Yeah.
Because, again, I was fed up playing live on the bass.
Right.
We were doing it with keyboards now and these things called drum machines. It was all kind of exciting and technology was just starting to appear. So we had to get a bass player and we had to get a drummer. Graham, the bass player, was fairly well known in the music scene in Perth, and he'd been doing lots of things. Fantastic bass player. And as luck would have it, he had just finished with a band that hadn't quite done anything. They thought they were going to do stuff, and he just packed it in. Right. And so that weekend, he'd come back to Perth, try to think, well, what am I going to do? And we heard that he'd come back to Perth, and we took a punt, and he said, well, you know, I'm not really doing anything. Fiction Factory wasn't really his style. He'd always been kind of rock bands and tight trousers and sort of long hair. So he said, yeah, I'll give it a bash, as you do. And the final piece of the jigsaw was the drummer, Mike. And Perth didn't, there wasn't really anybody around at that time who was free, just sort of, you know, hanging out in the street corner going, hi, I'm a great drummer. So we put the word out to an agent who we knew from our ska band days. And he said, well, I've heard that the guy in Simple Minds, a guy called Mike Ogletree, he's just left, or he's been sacked or something.
Right.
And we thought, oh, shit, somebody from Simple Minds. Well, we'll give it a go, you know. And so we asked him, and he's, as Mike does, as we now know, great guy. He said, "Yeah, I'll come along, try it out." And of course, having just come from Simple Minds, it was a bit like he was auditioning us.
Yeah.
But we seemed to hit it off. Him and Graham seemed to hit it off, and that's really where it started. As the five of us has appeared on the recordings, and we just kind of gigged around, and record companies came to see us, and that was it. And they eventually were persuaded, CBS was persuaded to sign us, which was
amazing. Yeah,
a stunning victory.
Did having Mike come in, like you say, from Simple Minds, did he raise the musicianship for yourself? And did he, do you think, because he was, you know, did it raise the band?
Yeah, I think so. There were some things that Mike did that I'd never seen a drummer do before. He played, although he's right-handed, he plays what's called an open style, which is completely not the way that drummers are taught to play. I've since learned that loads of drummers do it, but in at that time, that first rehearsal, that first audition, I'd never seen somebody doing that before, and he played some stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought, I've never had anybody doing that before. And so there was a real kind of, oh wow, this is a serious musician here. And Graham is a bass player, very musical as well, great musician. So they really hit it off. The three of us, Eddie, Chick and myself, obviously I'm just a singer, so there's not really much for me to do apart from just you know, do what I do. And Eddie and Chick, I think, were pushed because I think they would admit that they're not virtuosos on instruments. But it did kind of push them up, and not in a negative way. It just kind of did raise the bar quite a bit. Because I think we were quite a good band. I would say so, that we did kind of realize, oh right, okay, we're actually a band now. This is like a proper band.
Makes it real. And where did the name come from, Fiction Factory? Where did that come about?
It was actually Chick who had drawn up a list, because we were getting to the point where we'd been sending demos to record companies. CBS were kind of, you know, they were quite interested. One or two others, Chrysalis and Island. There was a point being reached where we were going to have to play live. And so we thought, shit, we're going to have to get a name, because we're going to have to say, come and see blah, whoever. So Chick had drawn up a list, and Fiction Factory was on the list. And it just seemed to fit what we thought we were trying to do, which was write music for other people or write songs for other people. We weren't really a band. So hence the fiction of being a band and the factory of writing songs a bit like, you know, Motown or sort of really stupid, grandiose ideas. You know, the Perth version of Motown, I don't think so. But in those days, you know, you dream big. And you that's kind of really where it came from was what we were trying to do.
What I love about it as well is I was thinking about it the other day. It has that very sort of German synthesizer 1984 sort of sound to it. Fiction Factory, you know, it's like Department S, and it has that wonderful sort of period sound to the name as well.
I think so. I think it does paint a picture. And I think it is something that has been adapted by other people subsequent to that. And I think, I don't know, obviously we're not overly calculating about it, but with hindsight, yeah, it seems to have, you know, it seems to be something that is possible for you to say in German or French or whatever, and it doesn't sound too silly.
It's like if Kubrick had made Clockwork Orange in the 80s, you know, you would have had the Human League, you know, you would have had Fiction Factory, Heaven 17. They've all got that sound to the names. Yeah. And Fiction Factory is one of those perfect names where you don't know what it is, but you can only imagine it's something austere. But I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
So, after that, you signed to CBS, and then did you start making the album straight, like Throw Out the Warped Wheel straight away? Was it straight in the studio or a bit more touring?
No, the relationship with CBS was quite tortuous. I think, you know, they heard Feels Like Heaven and a couple of other songs that were on the initial demo, and they were we want to hear more of this, especially that one at the start, that Heaven thing. So obviously we were writing, but it's almost like it's a bit like The Chaser,
right?
The quiz game. It's like, oh shit, we better write some more. We were writing. We didn't have enough for a set, so playing live was not really possible.
Yeah.
So we spent quite a lot of the time writing and being in the studio and doing demos. But the relationship with CBS, even at that point, was kind of a bit meh. You know, they were like, the more they heard from us, it was like, well, it's not Feels Like Heaven, is it? You know, go away and write some more. I mean, have you got any more?
Yeah.
And of course, you know, it Feels Like Heaven is Feels Like Heaven, and in a way we'd really kind of created a monster that we could, you know, anybody that says they can write a top 10 hit like that, unless they're Elton John or Paul McCartney, is lying. It's just an imperceptible blend of ingredients that if you knew what it was, you would you know, just reproduce it all the time.
Yeah.
So we created this monster, and we weren't trying to equal it. It was just, you know, the ideas that I had, they just came out and they ended up the way that they ended up. And so we couldn't play live until we had enough songs. So we had to keep going. And all the while, we still had a few options, but CBS were, you know, they just kept coming back and that was it. And there was a point where it looked like they weren't going to sign us, but for whatever reason, they eventually did.
Yeah,
they signed us on a 2-single deal,
right,
which was, we want Feels Like Heaven. You need to do another one, but we're, you know, we'll see how it goes, and we'll maybe give you an album deal, which is really what we wanted, because we wanted to showcase what we were wanting to say.
Yeah.
So it was a singles deal to begin with a tiny advance, because when you sign to record companies, people think, oh, you know, they get huge amounts of money. But we had an advance of £1,200.
Wow.
The thinking was, because there was, you know, we're quite naive, but we did have a plan behind this. Thinking was that we were fairly confident that Feels Like Heaven was going to do something. Mm. So if you have a very, very small advance, pay it back in no time, and then we start raking in the millions. So there was kind of a plan there. And so Feels Like Heaven obviously did really well. The second song that we did was a song called Ghost of Love.
Yep.
And CBS had a plan which had worked previous year for an artist, where they would release a single which would get the name known before Christmas, and then just after Christmas is a real kind of fallow period where everybody's kind of just having a bit of a rest. We released Feels Like Heaven just after Christmas, and it's going to go into the charts because there's nothing else around that's any good, or good enough to sort of stop the march. So that was the thinking, that was the strategy. They did that, that's when they decided to give us the album deal.
Nice.
Now, if it had been us, guiding them, we would have said, well, okay, we've got an album deal, that's great. Why don't we, record two or three songs, pick the best one, release that as a single, and all the while we'll be doing more songs for the album. But they didn't do that. What they did was, after Feels Like Heaven started, had left the charts, they re-released the first one, Ghost of Love, again, without telling us. Or they released it and didn't tell us. So perfectly within their rights, because they own the master tapes, they can do whatever they want. They don't have to ask us. But really, at that point, that's where we realised this maybe is not a relationship that's going to go very far. there was a lot of crap going around, and my personal situation wasn't great because my mum was diagnosed with cancer.
Oh, man.
And highs and lows of the 1984, in the charts and Top of the Pops in February, and my mum died of cancer in August of that year. Man. So my head was all over the place, and so I wasn't really in any kind of state to make decisions and do those calls, and it was quite a, that year was the big blip. If it could be graphed, the 1984 was the big blip, because lots of things were going on. So
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, owner and user of Mint Mobile, with a special holiday message. If you sign up now for 3 months, you get 3 months free on every one of our plans, even unlimited. Now, I realize this is more of a holiday offer than it is a holiday message, but if you read between the lines, you can see a message in there. It says, we love you. Visit mintmobile.com/switch for the offer.
Limited time, new customer offer. Activate within 45 days. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. Unlimited customers using more than 40 gigabytes per month will experience lower speeds. Video streams at 480p. See mintmobile.com for details.
We were signed to CBS on the singles deal, and then the album came along after that, and we scuttled off and recorded it.
That's fantastic. I think you should have released The Hanging Gardens. I think that's a fantastic track.
Yeah,
I think that should have been a single. Like, when I was playing the album, I've been playing it all week, but every time that track comes around, I really like that track. I think that's great. That's a great song.
Thank you.
You're welcome. It's great. Going back to Feels Like Heaven, can we just talk about how that song came about and the writing? Did you write it on bass, for instance? Did you write it on guitar, or was it?
How Eddie and I worked, and this was before Fiction Factory, and even before the ska band, actually, now that I think about it, we were really into electronic music and Kraftwerk all the way back to the first album. I was a big Kraftwerk fan. OMD, they were the Electricity. China Crisis was another band I was right into. I remember seeing them on the telly on, I said this to Eddie, actually, the bass player in China Crisis. I remember seeing you on the Oxford Road Show on BBC Two doing African and White.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, wow, what's this? It's a guy playing a bass and a keyboard player. It was like, oh, wow, soulmates, twins.
It can be done.
of course, OMD's bass player, Andy, and Paul, the keyboard player. So it was all these signs saying to us, this is what you're meant to do as well. So we would do all sorts of wacky kind of experimenting with reel-to-reel tapes and cassettes and all of those things in the days when you had cassettes. We would do all of that. And then the ska thing came along and, you know, we did that. And then we, after the RBs, we kind of went back to experimenting again. And so Eddie and I were quite used to sitting in a room together, just facing each other and just trying stuff out. And we had sessions really where we just pressed record on the cassette recorder and just started playing. And that might have been with the fragment of an idea that I had or that Eddie had, or we would just go, don't know, let's just press record and see what happens. Mm-hmm. So with Feels Like Heaven, how that came about was Eddie had no keyboards at that point. The keyboards that he had were all broken. So I, as luck would had a monophonic synthesizer that plays one note at a time.
Right.
A Korg M1 or M10, I think. So he was on that. I had a Boss DR55 drum machine, which it's like an envelope-sized drum machine. It was like I held the future in my hands. It was just this amazing black box with a big dial on it, and it was just fantastic. I'd saved up for quite a while to get one, and I had my bass as well. So I had this idea for three notes, which ended up as the verse, the basis for the verse in Feels Like Heaven. And I started the drum machine. Initially, I'd thought, well, wouldn't it be really interesting if the bass could play the bass drum part? And so a bit like Only You by Yazoo. That probably was the initial inspiration for Feels Like Heaven. I thought, why don't we get the bass, the synth bass, to play the bass drum, and everything else can be drum machine. Let's try that. So the pattern that I programmed up on the DR55 had no bass drum on it,
right?
And so it was just a snare and a hi-hat. And so pressed play, started playing the bass, and then Eddie just kind of doodled all over it on his one note synthesizer. And so we played that probably for about 10 minutes, just round and round and round, DBG on the bass, and him just kind of doodling away. And then we stopped, and then we went on to another idea and another idea. And we just filled up a C30 or a C45, one side of it with just crap, basically. A few ideas, but, you know. And so we put that in the drawer, did another one, put that in the drawer, did another one. So we had about three, maybe four cassettes full of stuff. And we went back. And we played the tape that Feels Like Heaven, the idea for, was on. We played it and we thought, that's not very good, is it? Let's listen again to another one. And we did the whole tape. And I think we were a bit depressed at the end because I think we maybe thought, oh, there's some stuff on there that could be quite good.
Yeah.
But on the second listen, it was like, no, there's not. But one of us said, oh, what about that one? Where there was that, that might be something we could maybe develop. And I was like, well, okay. So we developed that motif, and that was the intro, obviously, because we thought, well, that could be piano. And because we were still forming a sound at that point. We were not the sort of piano, sparkly, synthy kind of band. We didn't really know what we were trying to do. So we had the motif, and it was a very weird song with hindsight that we wrote with Feels Like Heaven, because it was very linear.
Yeah.
Normally, if you're a songwriter, you might have ideas that they'll slot in, or you'll think, oh, I have that idea, let's develop that, or that could stitch onto that. But with Feels Like Heaven, it wasn't that at all. We started at the start and we went and we wrote the bits as we were going, as it go in the song. So we had the intro, which that was good, and then we realized, well, maybe this the DBG that could be the verse. So we had the intro, we had the verse, And then we had to get to the chorus. And we didn't have the chorus at that point. Yeah. And we actually tried a couple of choruses that actually didn't really sound like choruses. We weren't experienced enough as songwriters to know that you have an intro and a verse and a chorus and a verse and a,
yeah.
We just knew that it was the bit that people sing, that people remember.
Yeah.
And so we tried a couple of things and I, by that time I was singing, and I'd written the words for the first verse, It Feels Like Heaven. And then I wrote the second verse. And we had this horrible thing, the thing that people sing. And so went away, came back the next day, and we said, right, we're going to have to get the thing, the bit.
Yeah.
What leads into this, you know, from the verse? What is the bit, what's the chord that we start with? And so we did that, and Eddie, who's is a keyboard player, so he knows musically what should go there. And he said, well, it does this. And I said, right, okay. Right, let's roll it back, run it again, run the cassette, and then you play the chord, and I'll do something. I didn't know what. And so we would run it and we played the chord and I don't know where it came from, but I just went, feels like heaven. No idea where it came from. And we went, that's it. That's the chorus. And we had that and that was it. And so we now knew that we had the intro, the verse, the chorus, the verse, the chorus, because that's how songs go. As far as we were concerned, and so it was great. We had all of that, but of course, we understood that pop songs needed to be a bit longer than that. Guys, come on, you've only got half of it done. So we kind of did the chorus, and this was all in that day. And then we thought, well, we've got to have the bit, the different bit.
Yeah.
We didn't know what old bit was, the different bit, and so. We were trying stuff, and there was nothing. We weren't getting anything. We thought, okay, let's just call it a day. We'll come back to it again because we got the chorus today. That's definitely okay.
Yeah,
you know, we'll come back to it. And I swear, this was like one of these Kids from Fame moments. My girlfriend had played the cassette, and she said, that's really good. Actually, I think that's. That's really not too bad. And I was listening to it, and late into the night on my own in the kitchen, I was going, that's that bit. What is it? And I was racking my brains. Couldn't think what it was. And literally, I went to bed still thinking about what it could be. And I was just about to go to sleep, and it just suddenly came into my head. This line, da 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 da. And I jumped up and I had my cassette recorder by the bed and pressed record and hummed into it. And I thought, well, okay, that might be it. Woke up the next day, played it, and I said, well, I think that might be it. I'll take it to Eddie. And played it, and we weren't, he wasn't quite sure about it, but you know, over the morning, I think we got something and we thought, we've got it, that's it. So it was a little bit long, but that was a very linear process, a very unusual process, because normally you do kind of slot things in, but not this time.
That's amazing. Do you still have those demos of those? Are they still around?
No, unfortunately, not.
Such a shame.
It would have been actually quite funny for me to listen to it now, because in those days we were quite poor. Technology was really just coming on stream, and because of that it was actually quite expensive.
Right.
They'd invented something called a Porta Studio, mm-hmm. which was something you could use cassettes with, but it would allow you to do four tracks,
right.
which was, you know, unheard of, but it was hugely expensive. So we couldn't afford that. And, you know, as I say, we wrote Feels Like Heaven on broken keyboards and, you know, bass guitar and a little tiny drum machine. And so we couldn't afford any of that. So I think by the time we did the first demo, Eddie, he'd got his keyboards repaired. So they did sort of work. So we had three keyboards to play with.
Yeah.
But we didn't have a multi-track recorder. The only thing that we had were ghetto blasters.
Right.
So we came up with the idea that, well, we're going to do multi-tracking. What we'll do is we'll record as much as we can, playing as much as we can at once on to one ghetto blaster. And then what we'll do is we'll play back what we've recorded while recording as much as we can playing on the next ghetto blaster.
Nice, yeah.
And so that's how we did our multi-tracking, and that's how we did it for the early part of Fiction Factory. But of course, as you do that, there's the tape hiss as you transfer it backwards and forwards.
Yeah.
So by the end of the first demo with Feels Like Heaven, it sounded like it was recorded by the sea, because it was like, shh. And it would be quite funny to hear it now, but no, we don't have those, unfortunately. I did think it would be quite nice to digitize these and bring them up online.
Yeah.
But no, we don't have that very first one. And even the fragment of an idea, that would have been really nice to hear back. The first demo we did in Elephant and Castle Studio down in London. And that would just all be nice to hear. But I don't tend to keep things. I don't have any memorabilia around my house.
Right.
You wouldn't know I'd been in a band. I tend to like looking forward. Eddie's a bit different. He does have stuff dotted around his house, but I don't have. I'm not a guy that kind of holds on to these things, unfortunately.
That's fair. So were they lost, or did they just sound terrible? Or did you just lose them over time?
No, they're just lost. They're just lost. They're lost forever.
Oh, wow. I wonder if someone somewhere will find a box one day and go, "What's this cassette?" And then put it in and go, "I know that, but I don't know anyone." You know.
Yeah.
I mean, hopefully one day it will turn up. It would be amazing to those early versions of it. It would have been incredible. So the album came out, and the album's really interesting. Throw the Walk Wheel Out. I really enjoyed it, and I love Hanging Gardens. I love Heart and Mind as well.
Okay.
I think they're great singles. I mean, if I was the head of CBS now, I think those two would have been the ones after Feels Like Heaven I would have released.
Yeah,
because I think they're all just slightly different. But because you really was it the Ghost of Love that came out, wasn't it? You said.
Yeah, that's right. Ghost of Love was re-released by CBS without telling us.
Right.
We weren't hugely happy because we thought, okay, well, Feels Like Heaven's left the charts, you know, let's see what we can do. And we didn't really have a say in it. And it, you know, it's down to the record company.
Yeah.
I think possibly Hanging Gardens was maybe recorded a little bit later on. So that maybe wasn't available. It was just an unfortunate decision by CBS, and it kind of really soured things for us.
All right. And then you went on tour with OMD after that. Is that right? Did you tour with them?
We toured with Paul Young.
Oh, right. Wow.
And that was before Feels Like Heaven came out, but we toured with Paul Young. And OMD was a little bit on from that. And that was kind of quite lucky because we were managed by the same management company, World Chief.
Right.
And it just seemed to be something that was a good fit. They were good guys, Andy and Paul. We didn't really meet Paul. Andy's a good guy. The OMD thing was quite an interesting one when we were bumping up against each other. You know, we bump each other against each other in the room in the management offices. And so that was really, really nice. And, you know, I wouldn't say I'm showbiz mates with Andy McCluskey, but it was nice. I mean, it was nice to be invited to the studio when they were doing, they were finishing off the production for Crash, I think it was. and I got to hear the title track. So that was really nice. It was just the one tour in the UK, but just good to you know, be good mates at the time with somebody who you'd actually been influenced by.
Yeah, must be lovely.
Didn't tell him at the time, obviously, but I wouldn't want to do that. But it was just nice to you know, see them playing. I would watch them every night after we played.
Yeah, I mean, you're only going to learn from your influences anyway, aren't you? So it's great. And how quickly did the second album get underway? Because another story was the second album, was it? So was it quite quickly? Did they get you back in the studio straight away, or did you have some touring time in the middle?
Well, because of the sort of the big blip in '84, some of it's a bit of a blur.
Okay,
but by the end of 84, we'd left CBS, or I suppose they'd left us. So we didn't have a record company, and we sort of touted ourselves around, but nobody was really interested. You know, we did have some songs that I was writing, and nobody was really interested. It was like, well, you know, it doesn't sound like Feels Like Heaven, really, does it?
Right.
Because I think, you know, we'd moved on. The Throw the Warp Wheel Out was a collection of stuff that I'd been doing mostly over a period of time. And so by the second album, I'd kind of moved on to be influenced by other things. Mm. And so it did sound quite different. So nobody was really interested. And so really, I think in January, February time, I had a really intensive burst of ideas, which really made a good part of the second album. And so by then, Eddie had left, and it was just myself and Chick.
Right.
And we went into the studio, I think probably springtime of 85. Again, it was this process of writing stuff as we were going. And it was really as soon as we could get in to the studio.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was being financed by our management company. So right. There was a bit more of a careful financial consideration. But again, we were going to studios that we'd heard about. We went to Amazon Studios in Liverpool, where probably all of the Liverpool bands of the time would have gone to at some point. And we were friends with Callum Malcolm up in Castlesound, and we'd done quite a bit of recording up at Castlesound in near Edinburgh. We went there, and that was great as well. Callum's a great guy. So yeah, there was a little bit ducking and diving, I suppose to it. But we got there in the end and produced something I think that I still really quite like.
Yeah. On my website, I put a playlist of the artists I've interviewed. So Feels Like Heaven, I've got it. But I'm going to put Lose Your Heart in Nature on there from another story, because I think that is a really lovely track.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, and I don't think I've really told too many people, but Lose Your Heart in Nature, although it was written by myself and Chick and a keyboard player called Paul Wishart, so it was quite a collaboration. The sentiment behind it is actually the flip side of Feels Like Heaven.
No way.
I wrote the chorus. That was my contribution to it. But the sentiment behind it is from the perspective of the person who was being sung about in Feels Like Heaven. And it's the idea that, you know, with Feels Like Heaven, the sort of short description of it is that it's not a love song. It's a song about a relationship that's gone bad, and the person that's singing dislikes the person eventually at the end so much that it feels like heaven when they go away, sort of thing.
Right.
So this is Leisure Heart Nation. The sentiment behind it was, you know, the person who was being sung about and feels like heaven is now singing back to this about saying, well, you know, why did you go away? You know, did you lose it because that's just how you are, or you know, was it going to happen anyway? And that's kind of where that sentiment came from. So it's interesting that you've picked it out.
Song,
but I do really like it. I think it's one where you know you can really, really push in that chorus, which it's a song that I get quite a lot from, especially in the chorus.
Yes, oh, it's a lovely song. It's one of those sort of you know, if you do a playlist of 80s gems that didn't get, like, you know, the ones that yeah. people just didn't discover, like, that would have to go on it. I think that's an amazing song. I love your track. It's lovely. No problem. So, I mean, you've got a lot of pressure on you at the time, and you're pretty much writing all these albums and that. And is this, like, did you have enough by the end of Another Story? Is that when you sort of said, that's it, I'm done now and fed up? Or
yeah, I think over the course of recording the album, Chick and I were sort of moving in different directions musically, I think. I think we still felt we had stuff to say on the second album, but I think by the end of it, we kind of, you know, we were kind of moving apart, probably growing a bit tired of each other.
Yeah.
I think we, you know, we're, as people were quite compatible, but I think both of us maybe had lost interest in it. You know, it's that thing where as you grow up, you're looking at Top of the Pops and you're going, wow, this must be so amazing to be on it. And we were on it a couple of times. And in a sense, that was that boyhood yeah. dream realised. And so to some extent, that was the box that was ticked, and probably there wasn't, apart from wanting to do more songs, because I was never really bothered about a public profile. It was all about the song.
Yeah.
And I think to some extent that was ticked, and there wasn't much after that that I wanted to do. I wanted people to hear stuff, and the idea that with Feels Like Heaven and some other songs, that lots of people agree with you, that the idea that you had was fantastic. That's a really unique thing that not a lot of people get.
Yeah.
Because Feels Like Heaven has kind of transcended the decades, more so than perhaps other songs of the time.
Mm.
And that is you know, an achievement that I'm proud of. And I you know, it's something that not everybody kind of gets to experience. But I do tend to diversify and digress, as you probably sussed out. I think the second album was probably enough. We'd said enough, and I don't think we could have produced a third album. I don't think.
Yeah.
I think we were too far apart. By then, I think I wanted to go off and do other things. I wasn't sure if I wanted to continue with music. I just wanted to go off and do other stuff.
Yeah, and become yourself for a little while, I suppose. If you've been swept yes. up in it for years, yeah, you're not living a life, yeah. really, are you? An amazing life and a creative life, but not just, you know.
Yeah. I think it was that idea that, you know, I'm you know, I'm not Harry Styles. I'm not, you know, Simon Le Bon or you know, whoever at the time. I'm just me, and I just want to write songs.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to know what the path is, because you want people to hear it, but when you're sort of knocked back a few times, you go, well, what's the point? Nowadays it's much easier to get your music out and get people to hear your voice. But in those days, it was very difficult. So I just wanted to go off and do other things. not necessarily music.
Yeah, and you worked in IT for a while. You worked in IT, is that right? You completely had a change.
I actually got really quite interested in music therapy.
Oh, nice.
And the technology was kind of appearing that I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting if instead of the people who were benefiting from music therapy, instead of them being reliant on the musician playing the piano or playing the percussion or whatever, wouldn't it be really good if you could put the power in the hands of the people that benefit from music therapy and you know, maybe have software or, you know, hardware that you could. The big idea I had was, you know, I wonder if you could have a special surface that you use a special paint and, you know, depending on the color that you choose and that makes a different sound and you mix the colors and, you know, depending on how you wave the paintbrush, let's say, that produces a different timbre of sound. And I had this idea that, oh, I wonder if I could be a programmer. And of course I went to university and discovered that I was shit at programming. There were people far better than me. I would get a technical spec and I would read it and I would ponder over it. I would stroke my chin like, you know, Vic and Bob, and like pondering away, going, yes. And, you know, yeah. And I would spend, you know, like a couple of weeks, you know, just kind of mulling it over and going, well, you know, how will I start this? Let's write the pseudocode here down on paper. And by then there would be the WizKids who'd have coded it up and they'd have finished it and they'd been up. Yeah. And there's me still going, oh, yes, oh, well, maybe I could start this procedure. So, you know, it was obvious to me that I wasn't going to make my living at that. So I went off and I became a software trainer, because in the days of the band, when music technology was making an appearance, everything was coming over from Japan.
Right.
And the manuals were all really badly written. And, you know, if you took the manual and tried to make sense of it, it was very, very difficult. So I don't know how it happened, but I would always be given the box that came, the Roland box, and told, can you go away, figure out what it does, come back and tell us. That'd be great, thanks. So I would go off. And so I was already training, if you like, to be a trainer in software. And I thought, yeah, I could do that. So that's what I went off and did. And I went down to London to work for a company called Executrain, which is an American franchise, who would, you know, train people. Microsoft Excel was my big thing.
Wow.
So if you're looking for any VBA coded spreadsheets, I'm your guy.
Thanks, man.
That was my thing. And then I came back up to Scotland, and I'm now working in IT at Dundee University. Being less hands-on, desktop support is really, really my strength, kind of, because I have a real thing for making computers and technology viable for people that aren't really, that hate computers.
Yeah.
I get really annoyed when my wife goes, oh, I hate computers, when something doesn't work. And it's like, no, computers are there to make your life better. You know, give it to me. And of course, it's a trivial thing that's easy to fix.
Switched it on.
So, my thing is making computers accessible to people to make their lives better. So desktop support is my thing. I like that. But as I've got older, I've been sort of, you know, moved away from that, and I'm kind of a ponderer that ponders over things. And
it sounds like a great job, though.
Well, it's good. It's good.
Yeah, it's great.
It's not a terrible thing, but it's not quite what I would do if I had the choice in computers.
That's fair play. So between this period of leaving the band and now, did you still carry on writing here and there and playing live and stuff, or did you sort of just shelve it for a bit?
Yeah, no, I'm in a lot of senses, I'm quite black and white in that way. If I can't see a point to doing something, then I tend to not do it.
Right.
And so to me, and I suppose as well, I'm quite musical, and I think that I suppose it sounds a bit kind of airy-fairy, but I suppose music means too much to me,
right,
that I don't want to just do it in a kind of half-arsed way. If I'm going to do it, I want to do it properly.
Yeah.
And give music the attention it deserves, if you like. So very black and white. You know, when I went to university, college, that was it. No more.
I stopped.
Everything was shelved. And I was quite happy, really, because as a songwriter, you tend to be a songwriter all the time. You don't know quite where your inspiration is going to come from. If you are doing IT, you do IT from, you know, nine till five,
yeah,
Monday to Friday, and that's it. Then you go off and you be a person.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're not looking for inspiration. You're not reading books to kind of get your next line or inspiration for a line. So it was quite refreshing. It still is quite refreshing, I think, to not be doing that all the time. You're not kind of furrowed brow all the time trying to think, well, where's the next thing coming from? I think music means too much to me,
yeah,
that I would find it quite difficult looking at my watch going, all right, okay, it's Saturday at 12 o'clock. Got to get up there for, you know, my 5 hours of you know, pondering about music. So I like the idea that I'm away from it.
Yeah.
And I can do these 80s things, performances, if they come along and they're a viable thing to do.
Yeah. I mean, wonderfully, you and the guys have played together this year, haven't you? It's 2022 at the time of recording, and you've played together this year.
It's kind of been like a leaky tap, I suppose, where we did do Rewind in Scone and down in Henley in, I think, 2011, I think.
Right.
That was one performance and then nothing. And then the one show came along and said, I want to do this little feature for you. And so we did that and then nothing. Netflix wanted us they wanted to use Feels Like Heaven in the Umbrella Academy. So we got together and did a re-record of Feels Like Heaven and then nothing. And so we got together this year for a couple of gigs. One was a Belgian retro festival called WFest, which is being held in Ostend, which was a fantastic experience. Great, lovely people, really, really nice people, really well run, really well organized. Belgium, you know, lovely place. Ostend, fantastic location. So if we don't do anything else, that was a great one to finish with.
Yeah.
And we also did one in Perth at a sort of an open air one day festival, and that was great. Nice to do Perth, and now there's nothing.
Well, I mean, because it keeps going round every year, something will turn up for you. I mean, I'm hoping for the day you're going to message me and go, Robbie, we've done an acoustic album of The Third Wheel. This is for you. I'd love an acoustic version of the whole album, but just see that sound like.
Well. Yeah, you never know what we might come up with. That might be interesting to do. I don't know.
I mean, it's just wonderful that it sounds like you guys are doing something together. That's great. Kevin, thanks for chatting to me today. It's been amazing.
That's no problem, Robbie. More than delighted to do it. There's nothing like this than talking about myself.
If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review.